from your hosts, Ed Whittingham, Roger Thompson, and AJ Littieri. This is the Climate Book Reviews Podcast.
Welcome to the first episode of Climate Book Reviews, where we discuss the most relevant and pressing publications on climate and energy. My name is AJ, and I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Ed Whittingham and Roger Thompson. Ed is a public policy professional who advises clients on clean energy, climate change, and industrial decarbonization. His past and present clients span the renewable power, heavy industry, and clean tech sectors. Roger is a professor and associate dean at Stony Brook University in New York. He is a historian of rhetoric who writes on issues related to the environment and conservation. Today, we're going to be reviewing and discussing the book Scrubbing the Sky by Paul McKendrick. Scrubbing the Sky essentially highlights the beginnings and the evolution of direct air capture technology. In simple terms, in my terms, direct air capture is the process of pulling carbon dioxide out of the air. Further, McKendrick highlights key voices that believe this technology could become the most important tool in combating a climate crisis. And it's for good reason, because although technology and policy that seeks to limit or lower our emissions is central to our response, it doesn't necessarily tackle the issue of the carbon already in our atmosphere that, if left unattended, will continue to have implications on our planet. What makes Scrubbing the Sky so interesting from my perspective is that it attempts to paint a broader picture, a more holistic reality around how this technology and, in essence, how topics around climate are truly handled, which is to say that it highlights not only the science and tech sector, but also the public policy, entrepreneurship, and economics that surround these technologies and their practical usage. It relates the political, economic, social, and environmental realities of commercializing and integrating a new technology in an already present system. McKendrick traces more than 20 years of development in direct air capture, relaying the words and actions of key world players we all know, such as Richard Branson, Bill Gates, and Elon Musk. But more interesting are the likes of Klaus Lackner and David Keith, engineers, physicists, academics, and entrepreneurs invested in pushing direct air capture technology to where it is today. McKendrick also portrays projects such as Biosphere 2 and Orca, the world's largest commercial direct air capture facility. And we'll get into some of those projects a bit later. McKendrick doesn't shy away, though, from highlighting dissenting voices in relation to not only direct air capture, but also spaces such as geoengineering, which I hope is a topic we get to discuss a little bit today. Obstacle after obstacle is discussed, and the appropriate direction for us to take is continuously put under examination. In the end, though, McKendrick paints a hopeful picture, one filled with characters that deeply revere and seek to understand Earth's systems. And I hope that this conversation today helps to not only relate the work and thought of these characters, but further develops the discussion present in this book. So without further ado, Ed, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on Scrubbing the Sky, and also if you could tell us a bit more about this technology.
Yeah, for sure, AJ, and thanks. That's a great setup. So a couple things to disclose right off the top. One is, part of my work is actually in carbon removal and direct air capture. Carbon Engineering is a client of mine. That's one of the three leading companies working to do direct air capture at scale today. The second one I want to disclose is Paul McKendrick's a friend. Like, we live here in Canmore. He's a buddy. We play hockey together. We ski together. But having said that, I can put my partiality aside to try to be impartial, because I think he's also a damn fine writer. And I have worked with him a bit on this book, and I'm really excited that we're talking about it. What I'm going to be doing, by the way, is a podcast version of this book. So I just want to disclose that all up front. But one thing, like, it's really important with this book, Scrubbing the Sky, that we remember the subtitle. So Scrubbing the Sky, : Inside the Race to Cool the Planet. And that cool the planet part is really important, because and there's a great New York Times op-ed that my friend and subject of this book, David Keith, that you mentioned, the Harvard professor and founder of Carbon Engineering, wrote about, you know, one of the least bad ways to cool the planet in the century. And essentially, you have two ways. You can do solar radiation management, also called geoengineering, also called climate engineering, which is essentially a way to, you know, reflect sunlight back up into the atmosphere to counteract the warming of sunlight. And that's that, to be clear, is an ugly fix. It's fighting pollution with pollution. And many would prefer we don't go down that road. Or you take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere to cool the planet. And those are really about the only two ways that you can kill the planet in this century. Because even if we stopped emissions today, no new emissions, the emissions that we've been putting out for the last few decades will sit in the atmosphere, and they are going to heat the planet. And moreover, they are long-lived, i.e. they take hundreds of years, in some cases 300 years to dissipate, and for then that natural cooling to occur. So the planet's going to warm, and that's a bad thing for a bunch of people in the world. And we have to cool the planet in this century to avoid dangerous climate change. And there are two ways to do it. And one of it is this form that we're going to talk about, carbon removal, which is essentially sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere. And the other analogy I'll use is, if you think of the problem, it's like a bathtub slowly filling up with water. And the bathtub is the atmosphere. And think of the water as being CO2 or greenhouse gases. So you've got a certain amount of water in the bathtub is fine. But if the level of the bathtub spills over the edge of the tub, then what happens? We wreck a house, right? And that's no good. So to avoid the bathtub overflowing, first, you have to slow down the flow of new water into the tub. And that's reducing emissions we put into the atmosphere, new emissions coming from, you know, electricity or making steel or making cement or when we drive our cars, et cetera. But even if we slow down new emissions going into the bathtub or water into the bathtub or new emissions going into the atmosphere, even a slow trickle is going to cause the tub eventually to overflow. So you've got to drain some water out of the tub. And again, that draining of the water, that's carbon removal. It's taking all those emissions that are up there already and moving that carbon from air to underground, sequestered in some geology, or to rocks through mineralization, or even into oceans, where we can increase the alkalinity of oceans so that it absorbs more CO2, and that CO2 is stored in oceans. And that perfect balance between water slowly trickling into the tub, and we pull the plug and some water draining out, and the level of the tub doesn't rise, that's the net zero part that we talk about whenever you see, like we're seeing this week, some big international climate summit, and everyone talks about net zero, net zero, net zero. That's what we're talking about, trying to get to that equilibrium point. So brings us to the topic of the book. And this is, sorry, I'm not trying to be the science guy, but I think to use what we're doing here is a bit of a learning opportunity. It's worth going over some of the fundamentals of the science. So direct air capture is a form of carbon removal technology, taking CO2 out of the air and putting it into rocks, putting it underground, or putting it into the oceans. And to be clear, a lot of people have heard of like carbon capture, capturing CO2 waste streams. This is different from that because it is actually that removal rather than just slowing that trickle into the tub. It's that draining part. And the neat thing about Paul's book is we learned from pretty early on in the book that we have known about this technology for hundreds of years, for going back 400 years, because Paul tells a story about King James in England tasking a Dutch inventor named Cornelius Drebbel with giving him a lab in the royal palace of the day and figuring out how you can create a submarine. And allegedly, Cornelius took the king and some other dignitaries from the court down the Thames River in a submarine, including going underwater. And the reason they're able to do that was not just pulling oxygen in, but they're also getting CO2, carbon dioxide out, because we know too much CO2 and you're going to die. And they managed to figure out how to get CO2 out of the sub through a basic straightforward chemical reaction. And that was the first case that we know of scrubbing carbon dioxide from air. So what Paul has done is he's fast forwarded to today. He's taking us back to the Drebbel days in King James and 400 years ago. And then he's fast forwarded to today and the recent two decades of all those individuals, the scientists, the entrepreneurs, the philanthropists, the ex-tech investors, all these people who have figured out, wow, we really need to do this on a planetary scale to avoid dangerous climate change. And we're now going to pursue this technology called direct air capture. And we're going to take it from this kind of mad scientist notion in the lab to actually commercialize it in a way where companies can operate and eventually build hundreds, thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of large-scale carbon removal or direct air capture plants around the world to counteract the effects of climate change. And you'd mentioned a few. So Paul tells us about Klaus Lackner, this visionary who is at Arizona State University, who has come up with this concept of artificial trees. And I've been down there. I've been down to Arizona State University. I've seen the prototypes that would unfold and their artificial leaves, if you will suck CO2 out of the atmosphere. He tells us about Klaus. He tells us about someone named Grecia Chochilnitsky, who fled Argentina and came into a doctoral program at MIT and started up a direct air capture company called Global Thermostat that has tried to build the first commercial prototype, but now has run into all sorts of roadblocks, and it's a fascinating story. And he tells us about, and you mentioned him, David Keith, and full disclosure, my friend, podcast co-host, who took a detour out of academia when he was at the University of Calgary, in Calgary, the heart of oil and gas country in Canada, to found Carbon Engineering. This, and I'm Canadian, you know, this born and bred Canadian company that is now partnered with Occidental Petroleum and is building the world's first commercial scale direct capture plant in your country, in the United States, in the Permian Basin, in Texas. And there have been some recent announcements just in the past 2 weeks about that project going ahead. So I should say, tells us about a third company, major company called Climeworks, founded by a couple German students who found themselves studying in Switzerland at the same time, Christoph Gebald and Jans Wurzbacher. They met on the first day. They decided to found a company, again, around direct air capture. They got the name because they were skiers off their favorite boot manufacturer, and they sort of inserted climate into that manufacturer's name. And now they've built a plant in Iceland that is currently sequestering 4,000 tons of CO2 per year in Iceland and using the geothermal power that Iceland offers. So, sorry, that's a long ramble from me, but I encourage everyone, if you're interested in climate and energy, if you're interested in technology, if you're interested in entrepreneurialism and how to overcome obstacle after obstacle after obstacle, and fundamentally fast-paced, like character-driven, energetic reading, this is a great book for you.
Thank you, Ed. That was a primer. That was a masterclass on carbon capture. So I really appreciate that. Roger, can you give us your thoughts on scrubbing the sky?
Yeah, I want to pick up a little bit on where Ed was talking. The bathtub analogy is interesting because what strikes me in this book is one of the large problems that they're facing with the direct air capture is it's effectively, at least in these early stages, like using a teaspoon to kind of scoop out the water, right? It's so difficult because the parts per million or whatever the measurement is so small, and trying to get that out is so difficult. And so that was, to me, one of the really illuminating parts of this book is that I agree, McKendrick's prose is just really lucid, clear. It moves along at a really nice clip. And it just helps illuminate a lot of the science behind it. I, for instance, didn't really fully have an appreciation for how getting the carbon pumped into the rock, how that would store the carbon, right? And he describes that in a really nice way in this process of calcification that's really interesting. And suddenly it made some sense to me. So I just want to start there. But, you know, part of what I want to do here is think about as Ed speaking from Canada, me speaking from, you know, a guy who grew up in oil land in Oklahoma and Texas in the U.S. here. And so I'm constantly thinking about what do the folks who have some sort of skepticism around climate science, you know, how would a book like this land with those folks? Because, I'm with a fair number of those folks, or even if those folks aren't completely skeptical, they're concerned about the cost of doing that sort of business and what it will displace. And it's true, there's going to be very hard trade-offs. There's no question about that. But what McKendrick does really nicely is he merges these kind of stories with the entrepreneurial side of it. And I think that will be really animating. And I want to say more about that in a second. The main thing I want to say is that the book reads like an oral history. And in that way, it's really lovely. I can imagine in the future, this book being the kind of definitive manual on how this technology got off the ground and the key players and the kind of some of the kind of whether they're apocryphal or not, stories circulating around the genesis of this technology. And it's equally oral or very, very accessible. It's a critical oral history. It's not just here's what someone said. It reflects on, ruminates on them. And to me, one of the core things it does really well is it talks about the motivations behind these folks, right? What's driving them to do it? There's I think at least stateside, and I don't know, Ed, if you had the same thing up there, there's a degree of cynicism around kind of the profit motive driving scientific innovation and what that might mean for our culture, right? And here what you see are a bunch of very earnest, well-meaning people who understand that in order for this to work, they're going to have to work with markets to incentivize the development of it, right? And so it demands a kind of entrepreneurial spirit to some degree anyway. And so the result is he discusses these motivations, and what's great about it is he dwells in the complexity of those motivations. They aren't always simple and straightforward. They're conflicted at times, even as they're kind of animating and pushes the people toward developing newer and newer technology in order to try to solve this kind of massive problem. I want to mention along those lines that for me, one of the most important chapters of this book, for me, while reading it as a person who studies rhetoric, which kind of is a simple way of saying that is finding the ways of persuading someone, right? So chapter 6 struck me as very persuasive for those people who aren't quite sure what they think about all this carbon net zero stuff, right? Chapter 6 is really, it lays out the intersection of business, government, and technology, and the way that the government has driven innovation in the U.S. especially, right? It's primarily focused on that, even though it's talking about global markets. And among those things that it points out, and I think is a really strong case, because I think it would be surprising to many Americans, especially if you're not familiar with the oil industry at all, but the way that the U.S. government subsidized the technology that made fracking possible, right? Mm-hmm. That was already moving, right? But it was basically massive investment by federal government that allowed that to work. So when folks talk about energy independence through fracking in the U.S., there's oftentimes this imagination that it's been done by private industry. Well, it was done by private industry, but private industry supported in large part by not just loans or investment from investment banks, but by governmental funds, right? And so if that's the case, if we can believe that, and I think of my friends in Texas, where Occidental is a well-known name, as you mentioned, in the Permian Basin, and already has this infrastructure that can be used for multiple purposes, as McKendrick points out, if this is seen as the next kind of potential interesting space for entrepreneurial spirit, I think you get more buy-in among people on the margins who might want to who might be sympathetic to the needs, but not sure how to unshackle themselves from some of their kind of previous ways of thinking. And along those lines, I do want to read a section of the book. I think actually I'll wait on that. But there's a really wonderful paragraph of an oil that McKendrick cites at length. It's a long paragraph, so I guess I won't read it. But the point of the paragraph is that it's an oil executive who's trying to transform his company into one that actually thinks more intentionally about the carbon footprint. And the whole point is that he wrote a letter to the shareholders saying it's time for us to make this transition. It's not going to be easy or straightforward. And ultimately, on the other end of that, he loses his job ultimately. And the notion is that it's harder to transform a company that's already in this energy space and to kind of prop up new companies. So again, I think about the entrepreneurial side and what that might do for the American mind in particular. If I'm thinking about what the persuasive elements are here, I'm struck by that in particular. Again, that chapter I thought was just a home run. And I do want to echo what Ed says, regardless of whether you are friends with this fellow or not, McKendrick can write. This is a wonderfully written book. It moves really quickly. It's a nice clip. And as you said, it's really character driven. So what you have are these really wonderful stories and explorations of the people and the minds behind this movement. And it's really telling and striking. It's a nice read for sure.
Yeah. Roger, I want to build on a couple of things that you said. And just said things were pinging as you're talking. One is just that analogy. I love the analogy of how hard this is. And you mentioned at the beginning, another analogy I would use is imagine an Olympic sized swimming pool and you show up one day, let's call it on a Monday, and you add a drop of food coloring. Let's say it's red food coloring. And then you watch it and it's sort of, it's going to dissipate in the water. And dilution is the solution to pollution. It disappears. Okay, well, it's gone. And then you come back 3 days later. So let's say it's Monday, you're back on Thursday. And someone says, now you've got to get that drop of dye out. Like,
that's great.
This is how hard it is. And given that, you know, we're worried about CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. And we think that it's, you know, the atmosphere is CO2 rich. Well, it's still very, very thin. And you're using technology to try to get at this drop of dye 3 days later in the Olympic-sized swimming pool. And yet these mavericks, these wonderful entrepreneurs and scientists have figured out, and each has a proprietary way of doing that. And it can be water-based, it can be chemical-based, there are different ways. And everyone's got his or her sorbent, the contactor that they're going to use to make contact with that that drop of dye. The other, because if you look at these companies, none is, you know, you would think, okay, well, this is going to happen because some big oil and gas major is going to get it, see it as an opportunity, and they're going to task their people to work in their labs and come up with this disruptive new technology. No, the three leading companies, Climeworks, Carbon Engineering, and Global Thermostat, they've come out of academia. They've had people who have had visions, and they've said, we have to do this. And there's this wonderful passage in the book where a guy named Alan Wright, who, if you pick up the book, he's got this fascinating backstory as a kid who tinkered in his garage with his brother, who was a submarine pilot, who eventually met Klaus Lochner. And they managed to get a massive injection of money for their new company coming from Gary Comer, the guy who had Land's End, the clothing company, and sold it. And because of an expedition he took to the Arctic, he really got climate change and wanted to do something. And there's this great, and Paul tells us this back and forth, where they go in and they sort of pitch him on investing in their company. And an advisor to Gary says, this isn't venture capital. This is adventure capital. And yet they still got the money.
Yeah.
And then to your point, you know, it came out of labs and they got some adventure capitalists who managed to put money in early on. And in Carbon Engineering's case, it's Bill Gates, among others, who are early investors. But as Jeff Immelt said, the ex-CEO of GE There's no major GE technology that did not benefit from early stage government support. And these companies as well, in addition to getting their venture or adventure capital, they're able to convince at the right time policymakers or bureaucrats that, hey, we need to tap into these funds and this is in the public good, because making money out of this is still really, really hard. And the last thing I'll say around visionary CEOs, look no further, and it's talked about in the book, of Vicky Holub, who is at the helm of this you know, old institutional oil and gas company called Occidental Petroleum, who has forged a partnership with Carbon Engineering through its low carbon ventures outfit, and is now repositioning the company as not an oil and gas producer, as providing carbon management services. And moreover, her investors, she's doing this amazing job of bringing her investors along with her. And one of the recent developments, they had an investor call just last week where they upped the number of direct air capture facilities that they say they're going to build between now and 2035. They said, we're going to build 75 before. Oh, no, it's crazy. I think it was 70. Oh, you never. And now, post Inflation Reduction Act and all the supports in the US, they've come out and said, not 70, we're going to do 100. Yeah. And her investors are right behind her because she has done this masterful job of bringing her investors along with her, even though she's at the helm of what has traditionally been a pretty conservative oil and gas company that has often raised the ire of environmental groups internationally. So anyways, all of that, I've gone off on these tangents, but I will say all of this is packed into this little book, and there are these great nuggets. So pick up the book and you can discover these nuggets for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think is key there that you point out is how she brought along, and McKendrick's great about discussing this, and this is again where the rhetoric guy here started picking up, where he was discussing about the need in a couple places, post page 100 or so, talking directly about the need for, he wasn't using the word communication, but essentially getting buy-in, right? And what that actually looks like. And buy-in here means quite literally, right? What's it going to take to get the people to open their wallets to support this project? Even as everyone, you know, in this circle that he's discussing, there's no question here about the need for a technology that does this. And part of the things that I would get myself excited. I'd finish a chapter. I'd set it down, and I couldn't help myself start thinking. I wonder if you could do this. Like, I wonder what would happen with this technology, or what are we going to learn if a certain type of computing moves forward? What will we learn from this type of technology that is transferable across domains? And it gives me great hope. I mean, I've got to believe that as more funding is positioned here, whether from either investment bankings, angel funders or governmental subsidies, you know, it will draw some bright minds to it. We've already got very bright minds, but it also draws some very ambitious people to it. And I think there's going to be, I'm hopeful that there'll be some surprises in that technology. I mean, there's a wonderful spot where he's discussing that kind of, I forget the name, the law, right? Big investment, then you kind of plateau, and trying to get that thing, that profit margin up after that plateau is difficult, right? So we're in this early first sweep, and it's in that area where there's all sorts of energy and excitement. And it gives me, I guess as a faculty member also, I'm thinking of my young students, and I'm thinking about what might they be bringing to the table that we can't even imagine yet, right? That is built off of these initial efforts by David Keith and others to try to do stuff, right?
Yeah, that's all very interesting. I do want to go back to something that Roger had mentioned before, which was this sort of hesitation in the public when it comes to sort of the cultivation of new efforts and new technologies, and particularly the energies and climate space. And I want to ask both of you this question. Why do you think that it seems to be very specific to the energy sector and to climate? Why is there not this hesitation for advancement in other sectors of technology, and why do you think that it may be concentrated in around, say, climate and energy?
Part of the reason, and AJ, it's a great question, but so let's think of something like, you know, the difference between working on climate and smartphones. The big difference is you have a ready market for smartphones. You have, like, you know, billions of people who want a smartphone, and they're going to shell out their money. When you're doing things on climate, so let's say it's you're capturing CO2 out of the atmosphere. So you've got that CO2. Who wants your product? If your product, if your widget is CO2, who the hell wants it? Because it's generally like the world doesn't want it, right? We've got too much. You're only going to sell so much to, you know, our favorite breweries who need it. They need a infinitesimally small amount of the CO2 that we produce.
We all need to start drinking more beer.
Well, we need to start more beer.
Sounds good to me.
yeah. But then we belch and, you know, the CO2 goes right back into the atmosphere. So this is the big problem, because your product is something that no one wants to pay for. And I should say, I should qualify that. Who's going to pay for it? Well, generally, it's regulators. And regulators like in California or like up here in Canada, anyone who puts a price on it. But it's a funny way of paying for it, right? Because what they're trying to say is, here's a price, don't produce it, rather than we'll buy your CO2. So in the case of Vicky Hollub and Occidental Petroleum, and why is it that we're building a 1 megaton direct air capture plant, the world's first commercial scale direct air capture plant in the Permian Basin in Texas, is because that's
really amazing.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the few places where people want CO2. Why do they want CO2? For oil production. You inject that into the subsurface to get more oil out, but because of the energy balance and energy economics, then with the crude oil that's coming up, if not totally carbon neutral, it's near carbon neutral. Otherwise, you've got this thing that no one wants, and then so you have to convince regulators to create the right policy incentives, the carrots and sticks, so that this product that no one wants, you can actually produce it in an economic way. And oh, by the way, if you're doing this at scale, the plants that you're producing are on the order of billions of dollars. Like, this is not, you know, we're going to sort of spend, $100,000, or we're going to spend $1 million, or spend, you know, $200 million. You're looking at billion-dollar capital outlays. And if you don't bring your investors along, you don't create that business case, then, you know, you're going to be, as a CEO, you want to do the right thing, you're dead in the water.
I will point out, one of the great things which Kendrick does, though, is point out that whatever those, at least on that one curve that he discusses, where the initial estimates for the cost, the actual deployment of several technologies previously have come in much lower than the initial things. I have some hope. And it is true. One of the areas where my brain started going a lot was, you know, what if someone talk about entrepreneurial spirit. Maybe there is some student somewhere who can imagine some use for CO2 that we don't imagine yet, right? Or make some use. I don't know, right? But it does. The book is circulating with people who see something that we don't see. And it's really exciting to read about people who have that sort of vision. And it gives me hope that there's other similar sorts of people, right, circulating around. I did want to kind of respond to AJ's question also, though, and say, you know, besides Ed's excellent point, like, what is your widget? Well, here's some carbon dioxide for you. That's hard to sell, right? But, you know, the other thing is you're up against, you know, 150 years of human development predicated on fossil fuels, right? I mean, the entirety of our civilization, you know, Western culture, at least, though certainly more broad than that, requires fossil fuels, right? It's not just that we're investing in that it's being asked to invest in a technology that might mitigate some problems. It's that it's a type of technology that implicitly criticizes the way we've been doing things, right? And asks people who've been involved in certain ways. I mean, the area that I grew up in, the entirety of that area, oil is, you know, it's Jed Clampett, right? You shoot the oil, you get rich, and you're happy, right? So oil is a promise for American mind oftentimes, not a detriment. And so the question is, what can be done? Now, Occidental is a really interesting case, right? Because right in the heart of Texas, right, using it to deploy more fossil fuel, this strikes me as an interesting story to be told, which I ultimately think that's probably McKendrick's greatest skill here. He makes something, I think, a lot about what it takes to get people to shift their thinking, and not in massive ways. I'm talking incremental ways, right? And McKendrick does that through story. He tells mm-hmm. really compelling stories. And we don't, the people who need the data and the facts and the science are the people generating some of the stuff. But what we need are people who can be captured in their imagination about what's possible with this and why it's necessary. And McKendrick is great at telling that story, just really disarming. There's nothing critical. There's nothing implicitly judgmental. It is all about how are these people making a living in a really tough spot, but trying to do it for all the right reasons. And it's really, it's an engaging set of stories he tells, really. And many of the chapters work just fine alone. You could pull some of them, right? And so if you're browsing right. The bookstore, certainly you should at least pick it up and take a look, right? I think it'd be hard to turn down. It reads really fast. I think I've said that a few times now, but please tell Paul, he has a fast reading book. It's really lovely.
Yeah, you're right. So I agree. And ultimately for me, it's fast-paced reading and it's grounded in humanity. And as you say, each chapter focuses on a different change maker, a set of change makers, collaborators, these mavericks I've mentioned, the scientists like Klaus Lochner, who is, by the way, sort of the grandfather of direct air capture and has inspired many. And at the end, it's this kind of gripping narrative about like big ticket transformational technology change and how difficult that is, and the unconventional thinkers and actors who are trying to drive that.
Yep.
And it focuses on this, what's still kind of a niche area in carbon removal. But if you enjoy books about, you know, if you've been fascinating of Steve Jobs' story or Bill Gates or Elon Musk or whomever it is, then I think you're going to get a lot out of this book because there are similar characters. And we don't know, down the road, one of the characters in this book could be lauded like, you know, one of these great sort of tech entrepreneurs and is well known, because we know the world has to do this. And it's just now finding the person who has sort of figured out the most cost-effective technology, but then has the entrepreneurial skill to scale and get it up to that planetary scale at which we need carbon removal to happen.
Yep. It's really great.
Yeah. And that's so fascinating to me, and coming from so much outside of this space, right? And viewing this as a complete outsider, seeing like the entrepreneurship, seeing the conversation around the economics of it and making it work. You know, like literally, like we need to get this funded. We need certain players involved here. We need to make a compromise, maybe. That is what's so fascinating to me, because I think a lot of people can, you know, relate to that, even maybe not within their own life, but they can understand this desire to have an understanding, but still need to have to make it work practically, right? So even if you do feel like you've figured it out to a degree. I mean, I was fascinated by just getting those numbers so low for the tons of carbon that would be extracted, like cost per ton, actually finding the right number that would be scalable. You know, it doesn't seem on paper like a few hundred dollars difference per ton, but when you scale that, it's a game changer. So seeing the reality of the business models that have to be created and the interdisciplinary sort of communication that has to be had was very enlightening for me.
That's great.
Yeah. So there's plenty of places to go here. Roger, do we have any reader questions? Or can we keep
I think we can tie it up. Maybe, you know, my hope is for the next show, we might tackle how to be a climate optimist, which is out by Penguin. And so hope to do that coming soon. You know, I don't know that we're all going to always feel optimistic, but McKendrick's book actually left me feeling inspired by the possibility. Right. What young minds might do with some of this stuff, and not all young minds, old minds too, but yeah. A lot of hope that some people reading this might see some seams in the stories, right? Because I could sense things anyway, right? I think, you know, what possibility is there? And I've been messing around in other domains anyway, and that's where those. It's in those kind of gaps where some really bright minds, I think, will see things that we don't. And it's exactly like David Keith has done, right? Pretty clearly seen something and that needs to be addressed and try to sort it out with a bright mind.
Right on. Well, I look forward to that next book. I have read it. I can give us a snapshot that I'm going to say very nice things about the book. Yeah, look forward to having that conversation. I've scooped myself.
Oh, good.
So dear listener, still tune in, but it will be another recommendation. Read that book. That's just like right. This one, Scrubbing the Sky, read that book.
We'll find out if we both agree with you also. See how.
Great. Thank you both so much. This is the Climate Book Reviews, episode one, and this was Scrubbing the Sky by Paul McKendrick. Go out and grab it. All right, take care, guys.